Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. A devastating expose of the harmful effects of synthetic pesticides, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was an unlikely bestseller when published in the fall of 1962. Immersing herself in a wide-ranging body of technical and scientific evidence, Carson turned a series of discrete findings into a work of enduring literature, one that has helped to change the world. Now, more than a half century later, there's never been a better time to revisit Carson's landmark book and its urgent relevance for today, which is what we will do now on Look is Focus as we talk with environmental writer Sandra Steingraber, who has edited a new edition of Silent Spring that combines the landmark book with a rare archival material, letters, articles, and essays written before and after Silent Spring's publication. Sandra's an environmental writer and research biologist, and she's led the fight against fracking in New York State. Sandra, welcome back to Look is Focus.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And I think the last time we talked was actually about fracking in New York State. So I wonder how, as you were working on the editing of Silent Spring, all the work that you've been doing around fracking and everything else that you've been doing for many, many years kind of informed the way that you looked at Silent Spring again.
Well, really, Silent Spring is the story of our time. And the script that it provides for us is all about the unintended consequences of technologies that indiscriminately spread poisons. In Carson's day, it was throughout the atmosphere, the upper atmosphere, right? So military planes from World War II, piloted by returning veterans who needed employment, were put to work spraying chemical weapons from World War II, namely DDT and all of its chemical brethren, all over our backyards, on our beaches, and our food. And Carson was able to piece together the signs of harm and lay it out to the public in a way that couldn't be ignored. And similarly, I felt a half century later, as one of the scientists who were working to stop fracking in New York, that we were doing the same, only instead of spreading poisons across the upper atmosphere, we were spreading poisons throughout our bedrock. We're blowing up the bedrock of our nation, a landscape that we can't see, pumping it full of poisons to extract the last wisps of oil and natural gas that we couldn't just drill through old-fashioned drilling methods because all the easy-to-get oil and gas are already gone. And so we're kind of conducting an underground pesticide spraying program, if you will. In this case, the toxic chemicals added to fracking fluid are intended to kill off all of the organisms that live in the underworld, deep in the bedrock, that interfere with the flow of gas. And that's why fracking fluid is so toxic, and that's why our groundwater is placed at risk from toxins replacing below the water rather than from pesticides that would kind of fall as a falling curtain into the groundwater. But the underlying idea, whether it happens in a subterranean landscape or in the stratosphere, the idea of broadcast spraying poisons over a landscape and imagining that the harm won't come back to us. I mean, Carson has words for us about that. You know, she lets us know that when we wage war against life itself, that the battleground ends up being inside of our own cellular machinery and injures our DNA in ways that place us on the pathway to cancer or birth defects or a whole plethora of different things. So, you know, 50 years after Silent Spring, I entered the fight against fracking as a biologist to bring some good science to bear on what I consider, as Carson did before me, a Neanderthal and barbaric practice.
Well, as I was reading Silent Spring over the last few weeks, I was really amazed at how prescient it was. And it's something I couldn't appreciate, I guess, many, many years ago, well, before all these things have happened. One of the things that really impressed me was how she drew all the connections so beautifully between all these different poisons and consequences. And as I'm reading it and thinking she's so prescient, I'm also wondering, could she imagine or how would she respond to what we're doing to the planet today?
Right. She does certainly appear prescient. And I was really fascinated in the part of the work for this new collection from Library of America to look at all of her correspondence with fellow scientists as she was piecing the evidence together. And what I finally concluded is that what looks like prescience or almost kind of a prophetic voice. It just turns out she's a really good scientist who had an uncanny ability to read between and across the data gaps. So she could, for example, figure out that DDT was linked to diabetes, which we now finally, you know, just in the last decade have proof that that's the case. But she was able to piece that together by looking at records of crop dusters and their high death rate, and then combining it with evidence that she was seeing in evidence from livestock and from chickens who were inadvertently exposed to DDT, and then what was happening inside the cell itself from some preliminary research at a time when DNA had only been discovered within the last 10 years, right, and was understood to be the actual agent for heredity. That famous paper was published in 1953 by Watson and Crick with a big assist from a female scientist named Rosalind Franklin. And Carson was writing, you know, within just a few years after that, and then was able to understand how poisons like pesticides could interfere with this cellular machinery. So, and then piece it together with crop duster records and records of what was happening to livestock who were exposed, and come to correct conclusions. So that what looks like prescience is actually a very brilliant skill set that allowed her to extrapolate from a few data points. So when we say Rachel Carson was right, that's what we mean, that lots of corroborating evidence has come in since then. But we can see from her early letters to other scientists what she was trying to piece together. And it's kind of amazing to watch her mind at work. And this was, for me, the fun part of pulling this new book collection together for Library of America. Just for example, here's just a few sentences from part of a 1959 letter that I included in the collection. It takes place when Carson was in the thick of her research. And you can see how excited she is when she makes these connections. And also notice that she's talking here as one scientist to another. So her normal poetic, lyrical voice isn't necessarily turned on. So she's just talking straight science. And she says, "Now I've tabulated all the pesticidal chemicals that disturb cytochrome oxidase, and a great light is breaking in my mind. I have never seen this connection fully pursued. Uncoupling phosphorylation from respiration may lead to the same end. Here again, the list of chemicals disturbing phosphorylation is impressive, and Weinbach's work on pentachlorophenol seems to tie up with a paper presented at the American Chemical Society's recent meetings. To me, it all seems to fit together." So when we say she's prescient, that's what we mean. We mean she did this incredibly hard detective work and pulled a lot of science together.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of people in the interim did not continue that work. I mean, otherwise, we would have stopped. We wouldn't be doing what we're doing today, obviously. But there are people like you and many other environmental scientists, writers, and activists who are, I feel like, standing in a way on Rachel Carson's shoulders and pushing forward. But do you see any direct links? I mean, after Silent Spring came out and it really had an impact and DDT was banned, but a lot of other chemicals weren't banned. And what would you have liked to have seen to have been the continuum that didn't happen?
Right. Well, Carson, of course, immediately after the book was released, faced relentless attempts to discredit her and the book from the industry that she was criticizing, and a real propaganda and disinformation campaign, very similar to what we see climate scientists experiencing today, was the brunt of that. And nevertheless, her work held up. There were congressional hearings at which she testified. She met with the President Kennedy's science advisors and received nothing but an endorsement from, you know, in the highest offices of the land. And then, because of the beauty of the writing and because of the brilliance of the science, began to receive award after award, medals of honor after medals of honor, and used her acceptance speeches at these events to push back on her enemies in industry and begin to explicate what she called a growing conflict of interest between scientific societies and industrial societies and kind of corporate interests who were beginning to infiltrate the pages of scientific journals, who were influencing directions at the highest levels of government. And of course, these conflicts of interest have continued. And now they actually go under the category, the more benign-sounding category of public-private partnerships. But at the time Carson was writing, she was really ringing the alarm bell about objective science being hijacked and being used as a tool to minister to bad public relations for certain kinds of harmful industries. Sadly, at during these months, when she was out there making her case after her book was published, she was also dying of breast cancer, and was in terrible pain. Delivered her last lecture from a wheelchair, and these speeches and lectures are collected in the book. I'm very proud that those final words of Carson's are there, because they really are blazes on the trail for us that we still need to follow. When she tells us that she understands that the work that she set out to do is not yet finished, but that she's now passing the torch to us. In fact, these are her final words in her final speech when she got a big award from the Audubon Society. She challenged us to continue the environmental revolution that she had contributed. And she said, "The effort must and shall go on. Though the task will never be ended, we must engage in it with a patience that refuses to be turned aside, with a determination to overcome obstacles, and with a pride that it is our privilege to contribute so greatly." I actually read those words all the time, and they help me in my own work as a biologist who is working to end the fossil fuel party and help, keep it in the ground, all these coal, oil, and natural gas reserves, and move as swiftly as we can to renewable energy. I see that as the big challenge of our time, and there's a very tight deadline associated with this transition. If we don't hit it in the next few years, then these runaway planetary tipping points mean that no matter how fast we decarbonize after that, there will be ruinous outcomes for us in the form of, lack of pollination. Our plankton stocks, which provide us half our oxygen, are now in trouble because of climate change. So I'm keeping my eye, as many scientists are, on all these metrics, and working as hard as we can in the social, political, and cultural spheres to make renewable energy seem like, the iPhone that we all want to have, and fossil fuels are the old rotary dial phone that we need to leave behind. We need new kind of narratives and new imagery and metaphors for energy and where it comes from. Carson was able to provide that for food and pest control, to put our feet on a different path, and that's what many of us are trying now to do in the world of energy.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Luxus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today, we're talking with environmental writer and activist Sandra Steingraber, who's edited a new edition of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. It just came out, and it's a really amazing opportunity to look back at the way a groundbreaking environmentalist was able to put together information and see the world back in 1962. And well, actually, she started writing the book, I think, in 1958, and to see it through the lens of our times. You were talking, Sandra, before we took our little break about the importance of Rachel Carson's work on your work and other people who've been fighting fracking and the fossil fuel industry. I wonder, do you ever think about what Rachel Carson would think if she were alive today and faced with fracking?
I do. I feel that she would certainly be part of the push for renewable energy in the same way that she saw that broadcast spraying pesticides over air, food, and water was a real primitive method for solving a problem. Could be done so much more elegantly and based on so much more science if we only looked to ecological principles. I feel sure that she would appreciate the elegance of solar power, community-owned grids. There's just the idea of blasting the bedrock apart in order to unearth fossilized corpses left over from the Devonian era. And taking them to power plants and shoveling them in and lighting them on fire in order to keep the lights on. It's a primitive and brutal technology that's killing the planet and killing ourselves. And so her words are really important to us. And just to help you do a little more fundraising here, I want to say this. This is the most physically beautiful book that I have ever released. The Library of America has as its mission to bring the works of iconic American authors into print, and they pledge to keep them in print forever. So this book is, I just love the font. I love the feel of the pages, the way the footnotes are arranged. There are photographs. It has a beautiful cover and a beautiful binding. So if you really appreciate just the physicality of a beautifully made book and the craft of it, it's just really nice to hold in your hands. And it even has one of those little built-in gold ribbons for a bookmark. You know, it's a kind of archival, it's just a beautiful thing. And it was a real labor of love, not only for me, but for all the whole editorial team at Library of America. When an author is chosen to be in the Library of America canon, it's like watching a Hollywood actor receive their star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, right?
But maybe even more enduring.
This means that Carson has really arrived, and it's, from my perspective, it's a belated arrival. But she joins a pantheon of other environmental writers, such as, Thoreau and John Muir, Aldo Leopold. And so to have this woman's voice honored as an environmental author of our time, a classic, iconic American writer in such a beautiful volume, it's an amazing thing. I'm just delighted that this book is now out in the world.
Well, actually, I should check on this, but there's not a lot of other women writers who have been included in this library, are there? Though I just noticed on the flap, Laura Ingalls Wilder is one of them. But
yeah, well, I have my own quiet diplomacy going on. and of course, I would like to see more women's voices canonized in this way. One of the fun parts for me in pulling this collection together with the whole editorial team at Library of America is not only, as we've been talking, to show Carson's genius as a scientist and a writer, and to pull back the curtain and look at how she assembled it, and also look at how she defended it before her enemies in industry. I mean, it's a real portrait of courage to read those writings. But also, I've included in here some of her love letters to her beloved Dorothy Freeman. And Dorothy, like Rachel, was really cared about nature, and they were neighbors up in Maine, where each of them had summer cottages. Rachel was a scientist. Dorothy was not, and so Dorothy served as a really good first reader for Rachel. She could try out arguments and passages on Dorothy to see if a non-scientist like her beloved would understand it. But in addition, she shared with her some of the miseries that all authors who face, you know, a blank page every day and try to put together a whole book. We all at some point sink into misery over it and have our doubts and our fears. And it was really Dorothy that Rachel turned to for solace and to share with her some of her fears, and also to reassure her that she should finish this book, no matter how she had become, no matter how difficult. She wasn't free to desist. And so I think that makes the collection very poignant, and also helps you see Carson as a woman who was in love and a desire to keep living, who loved the natural world, who loved Dorothy. It humanizes her in a way that I think we haven't really seen before. So I'm equally happy about that part of it too.
Yeah, I really appreciated those letters. I just wish that we could have read the letters from Dorothy, because I imagine those would be very fascinating too.
Yes. And sadly, you know, some of those letters were destroyed. Carson insisted that after Dorothy read them, that they be burned, because she feared, you know, that was a secret that they had to keep between them, in the same way that Carson felt that she had to keep secret her cancer diagnosis out of fear that the fact of her diagnosis would be used by her enemies in industry to try to further discredit her science. So we know secrets are toxic, whether they're about fracking chemicals or pesticide spraying programs or who you love or what disease you're faced with. And so to kind of lay all these secrets out in this collection that's both very sciencey, but also very personal, was just very meaningful to me.
Well, I found it kind of interesting when I realized that Rachel Carson had a beloved and that it was a woman, that I thought they were going after her for being a spinster and a communist.
Right? Well, I think the word spinster is kind of code for something a little bit different. And I'm sure Carson knew exactly what they were implying with that allegation.
Well, one of the things that I was struck by as I was reading this, I had these memories of when I was in summer camp in central Massachusetts in the early 60s and, well, probably early 60s, late 50s. We would go out for these hikes at night, and there'd be a truck going along the road spraying this white powder and these big clouds of white stuff, which, of course, was DDT. And I realized a number of years later that that was what I was walking through. We were told not to stay away from the cloud, but I'm sure it was dissipating around us. And I think about all my friends that are dealing with cancer now and our whole generation that is, cancer's just become a kind of a way of life. And I wonder how much of that goes back to, you know, the days of being sprayed by DDT and everything else that was in the environment at that time.
Well, we don't have to wonder. We actually have good data on that now, and they really do demonstrate how amazing Carson's ability was to see patterns based on only a few data points. So, for example, and I do describe the state of the science as we now know it in my introduction to this collection and take the reader up to the present moment so you can see what Carson had figured out. So she understood that DDT had the power to cause injuries in our DNA. She saw that it could imitate hormones and alter the pathways of human development. And, for example, it could feminize male roosters so they resembled more like hens rather than roosters. And so now what we know is that DDT is linked to breast cancer risk. And your risk is highest if you were exposed while your mother was pregnant with you, or if you were exposed during puberty. So those are windows of vulnerability. And so, kids running behind DDT spraying trucks, especially if a girl's breast buds were just beginning to form, raises the risk for cancer decades later. We also know that DDT has the power to shorten human gestation and is linked to preterm birth, and through some of the same hormonal pathways that it can raise the risk for cancer in the breast, it can alter the events of pregnancy in the uterus. And those are all things that Carson had a glimpse of that we now have definitive evidence for in the last, especially in the last 10 years.
Well, we're talking this morning here in Locus Focus about Rachel Carson and her books, her seminal book, Silent Spring. And we're talking with Sandra Steingraber, who has just edited a new edition that's been here for in perpetuity now. We will keep Rachel Carson alive for the ages. You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with environmental writer Sandra Steingraber, who has edited a new edition of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. I keep thinking about Rachel Carson trying to imagine fracking, because one of the things I remember from the last conversation I had with you, Sandra, that you told me that fracking was the most important issue that everybody should get engaged in. And in those days, I was obsessing about the tar sands. And so I was trying to, you know, think this is worse than the tar sands. But now frack gas has come to the Northwest, not in terms of actual fracking here, but because there's all these proposed projects for LNG terminals,
right,
and facilities and methanol refineries. The largest methanol refineries in the world are being proposed for Kalama, Washington, and right across the Columbia at Port Westward, Oregon. And so that's frack gas. And so we're seeing the other end of frack gas, which is not a whole lot prettier than the end where they actually drill for it. So I look at this and I think about the how to extrapolate from what Rachel Carson wrote about, and as you describe what was in the atmosphere, to look at how we maybe use her tools to fight the fossil fuel industry and to protect our communities from basically extermination.
Well, that's a really great observation. I think about that all the time. And yes, fracking extends its tentacles out over the entire landscape of our nation. There's no part of the United States that's left untouched by it. I happen to live above shale that's full of natural gas, and so we successfully convinced our governor that our economic vitality and our public health would be better served if we didn't blow up that part of the shale and extract the gas. But even in places like my home state of Illinois, along with Wisconsin and Minnesota, they're not, their bedrock is not made of shale, but it's made of sandstone, and their bedrock is being blown up to make silica sand, which is an ingredient of fracking fluid. Meanwhile, our coastal areas, including now the Northwest, become places for natural gas to become liquefied so it can be transported across oceans in places where pipelines can't run. So there's really no part of our nation that's not despoiled and contaminated by this brutal practice. And that's exactly that kind of ubiquity and the familiar nature, how we become familiarized and it seems normal to us. That's what exactly Rachel Carson was writing about. And in fact, I'm going to be talking about Rachel Carson's message for the efforts against fracking in Oregon in a few weeks.
Actually, on May 14th, right?
May 14th, I'll be there. Yeah, I'll be testifying at the Permanent People's Tribunal on the human rights impacts of fracking and climate change in Corvallis. And I will be exactly drawing the connections between Carson's message for us and this historical moment we find ourselves in as we urge our elected officials to pursue an unfractured future.
Now, where is that going to be? Is that open to the public?
It sure is. The host organization is the Spring Creek Project at Oregon State University, and the venue is actually the Whiteside Theater in Corvallis on I believe, Madison Avenue. So I'll be speaking on the 14th at 7 o'clock. It's the keynote event of the tribunal. The tribunal is an interesting form of speech, and it's new to me and exciting to me, right? It comes straight out of human rights. So to have a human rights tribunal that's asked to rule on the health, climate, and social impacts of fracking and have human rights be the standard against which oil and gas production should be judged, I think is a very powerful thing. The Permanent People's Tribunal in Rome is the tribunal who's asked to hear these cases, which are being heard all around the world. And so it has a kind of, what's the word? It's an august kind of ennobling frame to talk about human rights that are rights inherent to all human beings, which is, of course, language right out of the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, which says that we're all equally entitled to our human rights without discrimination. And to take that frame and apply it to what fracking does to communities, what it does to our air, to our water, to our coastlines, to the very cells inside our body, what it does to our climate, and frame it as a human rights issue, it's exactly what Carson said we should do.
Right, yeah, I was thinking about that.
Carson. I mean, she had a lot to say about the environment being first and foremost an issue of human rights. And in many of these letters and speeches and testimonies that she gave that I have collected in this new Library of America book, she openly talks about human rights and points out that if our founding fathers, well, I'll just read her writing because there's nothing like what she says. She said, "If the Bill of Rights contains no guarantee that a citizen should be secure against lethal poisons distributed either by private individuals or by public officials, it is surely only because our forefathers, despite their considerable wisdom and foresight, could conceive of no such problem." I think those are words that apply exactly to fracking, and I'm sure to use them when I come to Corvallis and deliver my testimony.
So if you can get us information about when you're going to be in Corvallis, we'll post it on the Locus Focus website.
Great.
So maybe through Liz, your publicist or whoever you want to do it. But anyway, she's got my email, so we can do it that way.
Sure.
So I wanted to talk about one more thing that really disturbed me about Silent Spring. And that was when I realized how many more chemicals she wrote about besides DDT, because I always associated the book with the book that stopped DDT from at least being used in the United States. But there are far more toxic chemicals that were being used back in the 60s, 50s and 60s, and some that are still being used today. So I want to talk a little about what they are and what's being done to stop their use.
Sure. Well, narrowly speaking, Silent Spring is about the toxicological properties of 19 different pesticides. And DDT is just one of those. And it went on to become the most famous of them, although at the time Carson was writing, they were all probably equally known to everyone. But her point was that it wasn't just these 19, but they were emblematic of a much larger problem, which was that synthetic chemicals, which are made from oil and gas, came into popular use during World War II, in part because our supply lines were natural products, like nylon was substituted for silk, and we lost our access to Japanese silk. Chilean saltpeter, which was used as fertilizer, was replaced by anhydrous ammonia, which is created through the use of natural gas. And so there was a move towards synthetic chemicals, and some of them, like pesticides, were actually played a heroic role in the war because they halted a typhus epidemic among our troops in Italy. They helped halt malaria among our troops in the Pacific Theater. And after the war was over, and of course the war ended abruptly with the drop of an atomic bomb, two of them, we had stockpiles of all these chemical weapons left over, and some of them we hadn't even had a chance to deploy. Like, for example, 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, which are phenoxy herbicides, which went on to become known as Agent Orange years later in the Vietnam War, those chemicals were originally intended to be used against the Japanese by pouring it on their rice crops and destroying their food supply. But we dropped the bomb instead before we had a chance to try them out, so we tried them out in wars years later. So Carson was alarmed by this because after the war was over, there was a real recruitment of Madison Avenue advertising agencies to make these, what were really chemicals of war, seem safe and benign enough to use to moss-proof the baby's blanket, to add to house paint so that flies died in contact when they landed on your walls. So somehow through advertising, the populace had to be convinced that these new chemicals that were synthetic and played a hero's role in the war were assassins against pests and were effective, but that they were also at the same moment completely safe for our children and our pets. And so that's the lie that Carson tried to undo as she saw years and years of research and development into what we would now call agroecological methods of pest control, but at the time were called biological controls. They were actually very sophisticated, and they were working. They halted a citrus epidemic in California, and so there were many laboratories that were working on what we now call organic farming techniques. And instead, after the war was over, all that money dried up and was redirected into this broadcast spraying. Carson correctly saw that as a regressive move. That's not progress, she said. That's a Neanderthal kind of control. And it won't work because ultimately the pests will evolve a resistance to the chemicals, and then you'll get just worse outbreaks that only bigger applications of poisons will be able to put down, just in the same way that if you over-treat with antibiotics, you end up fostering antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And of course, she was right about all these predictions also.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to have to wind down and raise some more money for KBOO, but it's really great to talk with you, Sandra, and I'm hoping maybe we can talk a little bit more uninterrupted at another point, because this is a conversation. I really like the idea of pursuing the connections between what Rachel Carson was raising alarms about in the early 60s about pesticides and the work that you're doing now and a lot of people are doing around fracking, and seeing what those connections are. So maybe we can do another show about that soon.
I would love that. I mean, I do see that Carson's larger ideas that what we love, we must protect, and it's starting to really awaken a nation. I was part of our story about how we banned fracking in the United States is now the subject of a new documentary film called Unfractured. I just traveled to Dallas, Texas with the filmmaker to screen it at a film festival there. Not only did it win the best documentary in the show, and I should say this is in a festival sponsored by the oil and gas industry. So the judges actually were able to say that this kind of message and this kind of hopeful activism to protect the planet is exactly what we need to hear. To see that message ring in the birthplace of fracking, in the land of oil and gas, it just seems to me a sign of the times. And so I think, however delayed, Carson's words, which really underlie everything that I do, and her insistence that we find sustainable solutions, that they exist and that science can help us find them, that we don't have to take the counsel of those who say there's no other choice but to poison ourselves. I think those words have real resonance and real power today, and I'm really interested in exploring that.
Okay, well, we'll explore it some more in the near future.
So, great.
Thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
You're very welcome. Today, we've been talking with environmental writer Sandra Steingraber, who's edited a new edition of Silent Spring, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, I'll be talking with Paige Embry, who's author of Our Native Bees. My engineer is Patsy Colbert. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out some music by Milton Nascimento, The Nightingale. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to support KBOO.
Oxinol tomou conta do meu viver. Chegou quando procurei razão pra poder seguir.